A very good Monday. Welcome to today's edition of the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In addition to feature agricultural news reports, I'll bring you national and regional agricultural news headlines. And I'll start with regional ag news right after this.
Unsure of your naval orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard and hull split from naval orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed, broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
In regional agricultural news, California's almond acreage continues to grow, but at a gradually slowing rate, according to recent reports. While the number of almond orchards removed also increased over the previous year, it was not enough to offset the overall acreage gains. According to an estimate from LandIQ, bearing almond orchards at harvest will cover 1.33 million acres across California. That's an increase of 29,000 acres, or about 2.2% over last year. This estimate looks at orchards that will be productive and harvested in 2022. In addition, a report estimates 59,732 acres of orchards will be removed before harvest, nearly 12,000 acres more than last year. These estimates from LandIQ's 2022 Standing Acreage Initial Estimate look at bearing acreage, orchards that have matured enough to produce a crop for the current 2021 to 2022 crop year. In addition, the U.S. Department of Agriculture National Agricultural Statistics Service 2021 California Almond Acreage Report gives a comprehensive look at last year. The USDA NAS report for the 2020 to 2021 crop year estimated there were 1.32 million bearing acres in 2021, up 5.6% from 2020. Total almond acreage in 2021, which includes non-bearing trees, was estimated at 1.64 million, up 2.5% from the previous year. It also said the 320,000 non-bearing acres in 2021 is a total 8.6% reduction from 2020. The USDA NAS report gave a preliminary estimate for bearing acreage in 2022 at 1.37 million acres, but cautioned that a major source of data for this estimate is a survey mailed to growers and is unlikely to be 100% accurate. USDA NAS says Nonpareil continue to be the leading variety, followed by Monterey, Butte, Carmel, and Independence. These reports are being issued side by side by the Almond Board of California to provide a complete picture of California's almond acreage. Neither of these reports offer any estimate on the actual almond yield this 2021 to 2022 crop year. The first full yield will come on May 12th with USDA NAS's subjective estimate. A fuller picture of crop size will come with USDA NAS's objective report in July. Bearing acres reflect plantings from 2019 or earlier. The removal estimates cover orchards taken out beginning in 2021 through March 31st of 2022, added to acreage projected to be removed through August 31st, the end of the crop year. The projection uses historical data and present conditions. Amid intensifying climate impacts, Governor Gavin Newsom has announced that the state has released an extreme heat action plan outlining a strategic and comprehensive set of state actions to adapt and strengthen resilience to extreme heat. The announcement comes on the heels of a heat wave earlier this month in Long Beach that reached a high of 101 degrees, 9 degrees hotter than the record high in April of 2014. With the launch of this plan, the Newsom administration is announcing an all-of-government approach to address extreme heat across four action areas. Those action areas include building public awareness and notification, strengthening community services and response, increasing resilience of the built environment, which means that as temperatures increase and heat waves become more frequent and severe, the cascading impacts of extreme heat on infrastructure and the environment exacerbate risks to people, the economy, and natural environment. The built environment track includes actions to protect critical energy, transportation, and other infrastructure, support heat-resilient communities through relevant regulations and codes, and scale weatherization and cooling technologies. And then the fourth part of this is utilizing nature-based solutions. CDFA is participating in the plan by helping to build awareness of extreme heat conditions for worker safety, working to create climate resilience centers, administering investments in a healthy refrigeration grant program, addressing animal mortality during extreme heat waves, working with school districts on edible gardens and farm-to-school programs, and facilitating nature-based solutions such as building healthy soils for crop resilience, among other initiatives. Projections from the state's Climate Science Center forecast show that all of California will be impacted in the years and decades to come by higher average temperatures and more frequent and life-threatening heat waves impacting public health and safety, economic prosperity, and communities and natural systems. Two bills authored by Democratic State Senator Melissa Hurtado, who represents the 14th district that includes Porterville, advanced in the Senate recently. Senate Bill 1219, Hurtado's State Water Resiliency and Modernization Act, passed the Senate Environmental Quality Committee, and her bill to prevent foreign purchases of agricultural property, Senate Bill 1064, the Food and Farm Security Act, also passed the Senate Agriculture Committee. It passed 4-0. California is experiencing a water shortage, one that touches on all aspects of our life, according to Hurtado, commenting on Senate Bill 1219. She says California is home to the fifth largest economy in the world, yet we have a fractured, antiquated water system that is leaving more and more families without access to clean water. Poor water management and lack of investment over the years has left Californians paying more for water, and now they will be getting less. Families will feel the impacts at the grocery store in their own health and overall quality of life. She says we have the ability to lead the world in becoming more water secure, but we must acknowledge deficiencies and aim to do better. The laws of water of the 1890s do not make sense today. California's drought conditions continue to worsen, and every part of the state will be impacted, according to Hurtado. The state is seeing an increase in water restrictions in some districts for the first time ever. Approximately 6 million people will be affected by the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California's recent decision to declare a water shortage emergency and order outdoor usage restrictions. In Mendocino County, water theft is leaving rivers and streams dry throughout the Russian River waterways. The problem is so serious in one district, there are concerns about the water availability of water to fight fires, and locks have been put on fire hydrants to prevent further water loss. In the Central Valley, drought has led to an increase in the price of agricultural production and farm worker job losses affecting the food system as a whole. Many towns across California have faced massive water curtailments and have seen their wells run dry, forcing them to jump through hoops and hurdles in order to receive just enough water to live. Hurtado said, safe drinking water and freshwater resources are central to the health of California's economy and communities. Pierre Lafond, the Montreal-born entrepreneur who ushered in the region's modern era of commercial winemaking by founding Santa Barbara Winery 60 years ago, died recently. He was 92 years old. There was not much popular interest in wine a half century ago. He realized there was a growing thirst for locally grown wines, so he founded Santa Barbara Winery that same year, becoming the first commercial winemaking operation to open in the country since Prohibition. In 1964, he began making wine in the industrial beachfront neighborhood that would become widely known as the Funk Zone many decades later.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
As agriculture continues its environment-focused movement to create a better product for the consumer and a better future for the industry, more and more incentive programs are being offered to increase participation in these practices. In almonds specifically, there are a slew of targeted incentive programs for growers and their orchards, many of which align with Almond Board of California's 2025 goals. In an Almond Board of California Training Tuesday webinar, American Farmland Trust's Paul Lum outlined specific criteria for one important conservation practice, reduced groundwater pumping, that San Joaquin County almond orchards need to meet for incentive qualification.
One, for that farm to have water supply reliability in the future, whether that's a surface water source, which is, you know, really key, that the farms are going to be an area that have some water supply reliability. Second is land with good recharge potential. Generally, that's productive farmland. And then the third, medium to high land quality.
Again, for reducing the reliance on groundwater pumping specifically, American Farmland Trust is offering multiple conservation practices to be funded. These incentive payments typically cover 60 to 80% of the practice costs, which include conservation cover, cover crops, reduced tillage or no-till, soil carbon amendments, and irrigation water management. All of these are soil health practices that improve water holding capacity and infiltration rates.
The practices fall into generally three categories. improving soil health, improving land management, and practices that would fall under water conveyance or on-farm recharge. So for soil health, the idea there is soil health practices that improve water holding capacity and infiltration rates. We see the list of six practices. Conservation cover refers to establishing vegetation, permanent vegetation in areas that are previously bare soil or bare surfaces. And cover crops on this list, reduce tillage, no-till, soil carbon amendments, usually referred to compost and biochar. It also includes whole orchard recycling. And then irrigation management. These are practices that improve on-farm water use efficiency. Could be irrigation system upgrades, installation of soil sensors, weather stations, focusing on improving irrigation scheduling.
Another area that is supported by funding is land use enhancement practices. Falling under these are critical area planting, hedgerows, upland wildlife habitat management, and wildlife habitat planting.
Critical area planting refers to permanent vegetation in areas that are degraded. So degradation perhaps due to flooding or to man-made movement of soil. So basically, improving the soil conditions in those areas. Also hedgerows, and then upland wildlife habitat management, wildlife habitat planning. These practices, I'm going to say reduce runoff in those areas, reduce erosion, build soil health, enhance soil and wildlife diversity, capture rainfall. So definitely a land use improvement or enhancement.
Another area of funding includes water conveyance and groundwater recharge practices. Groundwater recharge practices is one area that the Almond Board of California is looking into significantly and recently at the end of last year released a guide on it. Practices for improving these include moving irrigation pipelines, installing pumping plants, structuring water control, groundwater recharge basins or trenches, and on-farm recharge.
These practices, the intent is to move water perhaps from a surface supply and replace groundwater pumping with surface water. And that could be irrigation pipeline upgrades or installations, pumping plant upgrades, such as adding a VFD, structure for water control, all part of water conveyance. Could also refer to moving water to different areas of the farm to improve water efficiency. And then the recharge practices, direct benefit to the water table. And that's on-farm recharge or basin recharge or trench recharge. And some of these are practices that are in coordination with irrigation districts that are working on these practices. And we have a lot of information about some of the trials and some of the research on-farm recharge, in addition to Almond Board research and a lot of folks in the industry.
Part of the application process for funding of these practices includes a farm conservation plan, which is a whole farm assessment of land and water resources and crop management.
Staff from AFT and RCD and NRCS will visit the farm, talk to the farmer, walk the ranch with the farmer, and we'll determine farm resource concerns. We'll look at drainage, soil type, crop management, the crops on the ground, and we'll recommend practices to improve soil health, water quality, groundwater recharge. We'll look at runoff and erosion, types of irrigation systems. Recently, I looked at an irrigation system and recommended a VFD and some repiping, and some of the practices that the farmer might not really think about. A farmer may be thinking about soil health, but we could point out other recommendations and other things through our visits. So I think these plans are really important, can be really beneficial. We'll also look at biodiversity, habitat. We might recommend, for instance, a hedgerow in an area that you know, maybe unplanted. So the plans are, again, the first step for applying for a practice. They're free of charge. And I think, you know, they're very well received from farmers. I think it's a really great resource or a value add to practice applications.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary.
In national agricultural news, the Biden administration is calling on Congress for $33 billion in additional support for the people of Ukraine who are still struggling under the Russian attack. Included in that proposal is $500 million in domestic food production assistance. The funds will support the increased production of U.S. food crops that are experiencing a global shortage due to the war in Ukraine, including wheat and soybeans. In a release from the White House, the administration says, through higher loan rates and crop insurance incentives, the request provides greater access to credit and lowers the risk for farmers growing these food commodities while lowering the cost for consumers. Additional funding will also be allowed to use the Defense Production Act to expand domestic production of critical minerals and materials disrupted by the war in Ukraine. The administration says these proposals help address economic disruptions and reduce price pressures at home and around the world. What is behind the high price and tight fertilizer situation for fertilizer, and what's being done in that arena? USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford has the story.
Are the makers and sellers of fertilizer working together to artificially jack up the price to farmers? Are we too dependent on foreign sources of fertilizer? Is that part of the price problem? Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was asked about fertilizer supplies and prices at a House Ag Appropriations Subcommittee Thursday. He told lawmakers,
"We're working with state attorney generals who are currently doing a market study in terms of consolidation and whether or not these price increases that farmers have seen are justified. We continue to do research on ways in which we potentially could use less fertilizer."
And he said USDA has announced the availability of $250 million aimed generally at encouraging more U.S. local and regional fertilizer production.
Our intent and goal is to try to solicit information, which we're doing at this point in time, on ideas about how best to use those resources.
With the goal of having a program outlined and ready to go before the fiscal year ends October 1st. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The American Farm Bureau Federation and 119 other ag organizations have sent a joint letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission regarding a proposed rule that may impact every American farmer and rancher. The groups want more time to comment on the proposed rule called the Enhancement and Standardization of Climate-Related Disclosures for Investors Rule. The SEC now wants to require public companies to report data on their entire supply chain. Almost every farmer's and rancher's products go through a publicly traded company. That means farmers and ranchers could get forced to report personal information and business-related data. The new reporting requirements would create a heavy burden, even for smaller farms having few or no employees. Farmers and ranchers are already heavily regulated by multiple agencies at the local, state, and federal level, according to AFBF President Zippy Duvall. The new requirements would make an already complicated patchwork of regulations even more cumbersome. The deadline for partners to apply for the first round of funding through the new Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities is Friday, May 6th. USDA is committed to supporting a diverse set of farmers, ranchers, and forest owners through climate solutions that increase resilience, expand market opportunities, and strengthen rural America. This round of funding includes large-scale proposals from $5 million to $100 million that emphasize the greenhouse gas benefits of climate smart commodity production. The proposals should also include direct, meaningful benefits to a representative cross-section of production agriculture, including small and or historically underserved producers. A climate smart commodity is defined as a commodity produced using agricultural practices that reduce greenhouse gas emissions or sequester carbon. More information is available at usda.gov. USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack says his department lost thousands of staffers in recent years, and the latest USDA budget request tries to recoup some of those losses. USDA's fiscal year 2023 budget request of close to $24 billion is up more than $2 billion or 10% from this year, and part of that is to make up for personnel losses.
The Department of Agriculture has 5,300 fewer people working at it than it did when I left office in January of 2017. This is despite the fact that both the discretionary and mandatory budgets have increased. The discretionary budget has been increased by 18% And the programmatic spending has increased by several billion dollars.
Vilsack says Congress's failure in some years to fully fund pay raises has forced staff cuts in critical areas.
We have critical shortages in rural development, in our food and nutrition and community consumer service area, and in our NRCS area, conservation area.
USDA is asking for 535 new staffers for NRCS and 64 more for the Farm Service Agency.
I'm confident that our request will allow us to continue to do the good work at FSA offices across the United States. NRCS is a different story. The reality is we have to have people working individually with producers, particularly for those who have been historically underserved.
Vilsack is asking Congress for $50 million more to help those groups, $200 million more for the ReConnect Broadband Program, and another $119 million for ag and food research and full funding of SNAP, WIC, and child nutrition. In Ukraine, Vilsack says USDA is using $670 million in existing funds for emergency food aid to six African nations in need because of the war.
Delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian Solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
Heat illness for agricultural workers has always been a concern for California growers, and with rising temperatures, ensuring that growers are following the heat illness standard is more important than ever. Angelina Seja is the Vice President and Chief Education Officer of AgSafe, a nonprofit focused on providing health and safety information to the California agricultural community.
Being that we are in a state where it just is getting hotter and hotter, and we've got all these other environmental challenges, and the type of work that traditionally agricultural employees are doing, especially field operations, it is outdoor work. It's hard labor. So recognizing that they're exerting a lot of energy also then means it's not just about it being warm, it's also about the type of work that they're doing.
There are a few important elements to the OSHA heat illness standard which can help prevent worker injury.
The water, so ensuring that you have water. There's shade requirements. So shade needs to be made available when temperatures reach at least 80 degrees or whenever an employee requests it, which for most employers means make sure you just have shade available. And this includes your lone workers, which sometimes get missed in the, you know, we have a crew of workers out there versus like my lone employee who might be going to do something. Additionally, we have high heat requirements procedures as well that need to be included in your program. So that's if temperatures reach more than 95 degrees and there's specific procedures and requirements, including paid breaks, which can coincide with here in the state of California, we already do 10-minute breaks, so they can marry up with those. Employee training is pretty specific, so that's part of your program as well, that you're providing specific employee training. And this includes reviewing environmental and personal risk factors associated with heat illness. What is the company's procedures for compliance, the reminders to drink water, also the importance of, and I'm going to say this wrong, acclimatization. So making sure that especially new employees or when we have heat waves, that you're monitoring those employees to ensure that they're doing okay. Ensuring that we're covering off on the signs and symptoms of heat illness, and then that they know who to report that to. So there should be someone on those crews that is first aid trained that will provide first aid assistance. And then if they need more assistance, knows the process for emergency assistance. Which is included in that part. And then just having a designated person on site that then will be able to do that. And then your supervisors are also having to be trained. So an employer also, not just workers, but supervisors on how to handle that information, how to handle those situations, and knows where the plan is and follows through with the plan. And that's really kind of like the essential pieces of your plan or your program.
Some elements of the health illness standard are the most likely to be missed by growers.
The lone workers gets forgotten, right? We just kind of give for a given that they know that they're taking water and that they're taking their breaks, et cetera. That written program tends to catch some people. They'll have the shade, they'll have the water, and then they'll be asked for that rent program and they'll say, oh, it's in the office and it needs to be physically where the employees are. Rendering and providing first aid if someone is not feeling well. Again, the monitoring of employees throughout the day to ensure that they're still doing okay. And then the providing, again, it doesn't have to be something, you're not required, you're not a medical provider, but you need to provide essential, first aid. And so sometimes the recognition that an employee might not be feeling well, and then that you have, someone has to monitor that, right? Assigning an individual to monitor those individuals to just ensure either did they get better or do we need to call for assistance or take them somewhere to get further medical assistance. Tend to be sometimes like, those blind spots. It's like, oh yeah, this is where people get in trouble. So
without ensuring that each element of the plan is properly carried out, a number of consequences can occur.
You obviously don't want to have an injured worker. So someone who actually, he gets sick or suffers heat illness or heat stroke. The different types. So obviously the ramifications, a sick worker or potentially a fatality, which is, are that extreme. There are citations. Cal OSHA, this is probably one of the more cited, so if you're looking at legal, compliance issues, so enforcement, most definitely this is usually ranks in agriculture ranks between 1 and 2. If memory serves me well, I think this was ranked 1 this year. So this past year. Yeah. So, the ramifications, obviously you don't want to have an employee that's sick. And number 2, just ensuring that you're providing all of these things. And typically that written program is one of the, I would say it ranks pretty high in terms of, we all know we're supposed to do it. And then making sure it's there and available to employees and obviously your enforcement if they come out. So just making sure that you have it, that you're looking at it, is another one too. Sometimes they sit kind of static and we should really be looking at them.
Fortunately, growers have a number of resources for helping them understand and follow the heat illness standard.
We've developed a couple of trainings around heat illness prevention program. Our approach typically has been to train your supervisors to then ensure that your workers get trained. So we do a train the trainer program. Cal OSHA has excellent resources and posters. There's also UC Davis Western Center for Agricultural Health and Safety, Health and Safety. And they also have excellent resources that are available, typically free of charge. You just have to download them from their websites call the entities. But there are a lot of resources, especially here in California. Associations have resources around heat illness in multiple languages, English, Spanish, and some of the other more commonly spoken languages as well.
For My Ag Life Daily News, I'm Patrick Cotter.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.